Hello, I'm Kathy Van Skoik, coming to you from my home in Victor. This is my first attempt at recording away from the studio with hopes of providing you with some new programs beyond the reruns that have been broadcast lately in the recent podcast. There's been podcasts of Silver Threads on many of the programs that play podcasts like iTunes, Listen Notes, Stitcher, and of course, WXXI.org. It was my 40-year-old son, though, who alerted me to Stitcher. He works as a commercial painter and often plugs into the channel while working. Over coffee one day, he expressed his shock and surprise at hearing his mother's voice in his earbuds one day. Sure enough, the station was playing a Silver Threads program. An article from Next Avenue introduced me to another podcast called Legacy Matters, the vehicle three Minneapolis friends created for members of their community to share stories. From that March 16, 2020 article, Safeguarding Memories, Telling Stories, followed others about the importance of sharing stories. The author of Remembering the Love of Grandparents shared a surprising story about her grandfather, a butcher, and a godfather in the mafia. The Power of Sharing Our Stories by Raina Mardergentin, February 2018, is a life-affirming story itself about being old, vulnerable, and cognitively impaired. I'll begin with Safeguarding Memories, Telling Stories. On a table crowded with microphones and wires, Sam Thiessen-Devine places an unpainted wooden truck outfitted with chunky wheels. At first glance, the simple toy appears to be a well-loved memento from Devine's childhood. But this is an object that holds memories and stories, and ultimately played a part in the inspiration beyond kinetic legacy, a Minneapolis-based company founded by Devine, James Holmberg, and Sarah Anderson in 2018. In more than one way, Kinetic Legacy is focused on stories. The microphones are set for the company's Legacy Matters podcast, featuring hour-long kitchen table conversations with a host of individuals from the Twin Cities community, all ages, professions, and avocations, some well-known and some not. More on that later. For now, the truck. When I was a kid, one of my fondest memories was going to my grandfather's garage after school and building things with him, says Devine, 45. Adding, the truck dates to around 1983, not long before his grandfather died of lung cancer. A couple of years ago, Devine posted a picture of the truck on his Facebook page, reminiscing about the experience of making it with his grandfather. Before long, my cousins were climbing in with their own experiences of building things with Grandpa, said Devine. All of us had our own stories. Devine began pondering how his family members could curate those stories and images and privately share them, not only with each other, but with others who were now part of their lives, away from social media outlets like Facebook. Around that time, Holmberg, 52, was facing a problem common to many of his generation. His parents had died, and he was left with a garage filled with their stuff. I felt guilty about throwing things away because there were so many memories and stories attached to all of it, Holmberg said. Decluttering is so hard. What do you do? What do you do with all of those things that have been left behind? Creating a social legacy app. As Devine and Holmberg discovered, they weren't alone in wanting to find a solution to preserve images and stories behind cherished items. The two have known each other for more than 15 years and worked together in the design and build industry on home and commercial projects. Our clients would talk to us about all the items they had and how they wished there was some way that they could record the stories of the history and meaning behind their things, Holmberg said. As the two saw it, the challenge was to capture the images of well-loved items while at the same time finding an easy way to attach something even more precious, their stories. The context behind our important items is so valuable because it can be so easily lost through the generations, said Holmberg. Eventually, the description of any object can end up being, "Oh, I don't know much about it. It's just been in the family for a long time." But a lot of times, there is much more to the story. Working with a developer from northern Minnesota, Divine Anderson and Holmberg created Andelin, a social legacy app for people who want to have an easily accessible and shareable way to store photos and stories about the people, places, events, and things which have significance to them. Andelin is the name of Divine's 3-year-old daughter. Not only can people upload photos, videos, oral and written stories, but the free app, which works on phones and tablets, also has a geolocation feature, so the exact location of a place or object can be digitally recognized. Traveling down memory lane can be done simply, said Divine. The school I attended in third grade is geolocated, and so is the house I lived in with my parents and grandparents, which was just a few blocks away from the school. I have uploaded a photo of my grandfather, a picture of the house with the garage where we worked on our projects together, and a photo of the truck, he said, adding that he wishes he would have been able to include his grandfather's voice. This specific memory can be shared with his cousins, and they can add their stories too. A curated memory of a kid's truck can display the image, the place it was created, and the people's lives it touched, Divine explains. Divine refers to Andelin as a canvas and explains that if users put the time into collecting important memories on the app, they will have something beautiful to enjoy and something that others can enjoy as well. Andelin also gives families the opportunity to share stories and images with loved ones suffering from memory problems. For example, the images shared on Andelin could spark familiarity about family members, recognition of beloved places and items, and also help provoke memories and conversation. Something that has surprised Holmberg, the positive reaction Andelin has received from young people. A 16-year-old teenager and his family recently downloaded the app and reported that he liked that he could keep photos of friends and events private. A lot of young people are moving away from participating in social media because they don't like the public part of it, said Holmberg. Many are sentimental about their childhood memories and want to share photos and things like that with people they choose. They see right through Facebook, and they like being a little bit off the grid. To access the Andelin app, currently free on the App Store, users have to log in with a valid email address. An Andelin account cannot be accessed through Google or Facebook. The image stored is all cloud-based and secure. Privacy is the most important thing to us, said Anderson, who is also the marketing director for Kinetic Legacy. As Divine, we are safeguarding memories, and we take that very seriously. While Andelin is user-friendly for all ages, Anderson said the older generation was top of mind when it came to designing features of the app. The text size and the size of the buttons were taken into consideration, she said, and as the team continues to perfect Andelin, Anderson says that they are striving to make the user experience as easy as possible and welcome email feedback. To further lean into the importance of storytelling, in October 2018, Divine, Anderson, and Holmberg decided to launch a podcast called Legacy Matters, where they invite a guest into their Northeast Minneapolis studio for a free-ranging conversation. They recently released their 100th episode. Just as the app shares stories of people and places, we'd like our podcast to do the same, said Divine. We invite members of the community so that we and our listeners can find out who we are living here. Guests have included organic farmers, firefighters, writers and media personalities, musicians, community activists, and others. with notables such as explorer Will Steger and musician Chan Poling of The Suburbs, a popular Twin Cities band. The host technique is a bit unusual. We purposely don't do much research. There are no notes or scripts. We look at it as a kitchen table conversation. Like these people are new neighbors who just moved in next door, and we're inviting them to get to know them a little bit better, said Devine. Listening to a podcast, all episodes are available on podcast channels, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Listen Notes. It's easy to pick up on the chemistry between the three hosts, and before long, the guests seem at ease as well. We'll often hear from people that the experience was one they weren't expecting, or that we got them to share something they had never shared, said Holmberg. For Holmberg, Devine, and Anderson, everything comes down to the power of story, and including the word legacy in their company name was of primary importance. History looks backward, but legacy is what you leave for the future, said Devine. It's how people in the next generations will be able to know more about you. And that was written by Julie Fitzinger, editor for Next Avenue's lifestyle coverage. And we're going to move on now to Remembering the Love of Grandparents by Dana Klausner-Weiner. There's a small apartment in Brooklyn where the letter C adorns the door. Behind that door is a hidden treasure trove of love and memories. My mother grew up in that apartment along with my uncle and grandparents. It's a small one-bedroom where family love seeps through every corner. To this day, my 85-year-old mother idolizes her 86-year-old brother. My mother loves to recall the days in 1940s Brooklyn when her brother went to the High School of Performing Arts in Manhattan. When my mother looks back, her eyes glisten. In those days, her brother, now a retired art director from Life magazine and Warner Brothers, and his deviant buddies would cut school, but never got into trouble. In fact, their parents never found out. My mother would write him notes and forge their mother's signature. Grandma was none the wiser. All our lives, my sisters, cousins, and I heard how bad this gang of performing arts school boys were. In old pictures, they looked just like the guys in The Lords of Flatbush. They were that good-looking, with that same glimmer in their eyes. My mother recalls how all of her friends had a crush on her brother. All the girls would clamor to come over to Mom's just to catch a glimpse of her beautiful artist brother and his friends. Having all those kids in that small space couldn't have been easy, but their home was always open. My mom and her brother didn't have bedrooms, but they didn't mind. My grandparents, of course, had the bedroom, and my mom and her brother each slept on a separate couch, one in the living room and one in the hallway. As teens, one always had to let the other one know when they had a date coming over. A lifetime went by. My mom and uncle grew up and got married. In fact, their weddings and that of a first cousin who lived in the apartment next door were all within 6 weeks of each other. All six of them liked to joke that if they had spaced their weddings further apart, they would have gotten better presents. They all moved into a single-family home in the suburbs. My grandparents stayed in the apartment for more than 50 years. After my sisters and I were born, my mother would schlep, as the natives say, from Long Island to Brooklyn every Sunday with all three of her young girls in tow. We loved visiting Grandma Sophie and Grandpa Barney. Grandma always had something cooking on the stove, matzo balls or chicken, cooked in the chicken fat she saved. She also saved pennies in a jar, and we would count them out and split them three ways. It never split evenly, and one of us would always get an extra. Grandpa would be sitting in his chair, smoking a cigar, and reading the New York Times. He would hug us so hard we couldn't breathe, and we loved it. Grandpa was the original Archie Bunker, opinionated and, yes, a little bigoted. My older sister would add on to her boyfriend's last names to make them sound Jewish, like Levitin Ski. I kid you not. Grandma was a quieter love. As kids, we never saw evidence of it, as they had her medications perfected by the time we came along, but she was manic depressive, now called bipolar, in the days before lithium. In fact, she was one of the first patients to receive the miracle drug that saved her life. My grandpa, small in stature, a cigar always in hand, had a belly laugh that was contagious. His days as a butcher in Brooklyn sounded like something out of The Godfather. He loved to regale us with stories. He was a butcher his entire adult life. In 1911, he emigrated from Russia when he was only 12. He came over by himself, and I believe his mother and siblings followed later. He and Grandma met when he showed up at her brother's butcher shop as a temporary butcher. She was the cashier. While Grandpa was working there, he cut off his index finger from the first knuckle. The story he loved to tell was that Sophie was so beautiful he couldn't take his eyes off her. So while he was directing the meat over the meat cutter, he was staring at her and not paying attention and cut his finger off. He put the cut-off tip on ice and brought it to the hospital, hoping they could sew it back on. But in the 1920s, that was not possible. The stub became his badge of honor and his emblem of an undying love. In 1930s Brooklyn, butchers and other small businesses had to pay protection money to the mafia to ensure that nothing bad would happen to their shops. Grandpa was no exception. A cousin of the head of the family was at Grandpa's shop collecting when he suffered a heart attack. Grandpa would never let a man suffer on his watch. Instead of waiting for the ambulance to arrive, he loaded the cousin into his car and rushed him to the hospital, with those few minutes saving the man's life. From then on, Grandpa was in the family's good graces. He never had to pay protection money again, and not only that, they offered Grandpa, a man who was raising his family in that one-bedroom apartment, a mansion. Family legend has it that Grandpa didn't want to be controlled by the mafia, so he respectfully refused the offer. But they never forgot what Grandpa did. Grandma and Grandpa attended the head of the family's daughter's wedding, and in later years, when Grandpa fell ill and was hospitalized many times, he always had a 24-hour nurse by his side. My grandparents are long gone. Grandma passed first. A year later, Grandpa died of a broken heart. Another family lives in that apartment now. If we were to knock on that door adorned with a C, a stranger would answer, but we would still be able to feel the love seeping through the cracks. Dana Klausner-Weiner's work has been published in the Washington Post and Newsday. And now we're going to finish up with The Power of Sharing Stories by Raina Marder Genton. My friend runs an assisted living residence not far from where I live. When she called to say that she had a mitzvah, a good deed, for me that was right up my alley, I was wary, to put it mildly. She explained that she was running an event where the residents would play a game encouraging them to share, open mic style, stories from their lives. My friend knows I write essays, memoir pieces, a novel, and I tell stories. Will you come? She asked. I wanted to say, no. As my children will tell you, with the rare exception of Shabbat, round, or Scrabble, or bananagrams, I don't play games. Maybe I'm uptight, or just no fun, but games are not my thing. The idea of helping to facilitate an octogenarian quiz show was not high on my list. But the truth is, this event was out of my comfort zone for reasons having nothing to do with my game aversion. Lately, many of my friends have been investigating, planning, or cajoling their aging parents into moving out of their homes. Those who are lucky will relocate as intact couples. Husbands and wives facing this enormous transition together. Many others need to move because they are now alone. My friends optimistically talk about their parents' new circumstances. There will be meals, nurses and social workers on site, and transportation to medical appointments, they say. And most of all, there will be socialization. art lessons and book groups and Zumba, a year-round summer camp for old folks to fight off the isolation. Well, for better or worse, my own parents never lived in one of those seemingly idyllic places. My father died at 70, too young and basically too healthy to need that sort of situation. My mother lived into her mid-80s and stubbornly remained in her house, fiercely independent to the end, long past when being alone in suburbia made any sense at all. Although I didn't tell my friend, and I couldn't have articulated it if I wanted to, the idea of participating in her program made me sad, but how could I not give an hour of my time? My friend meets me in the reception area of the facility, where the residents are lounging, many speaking animatedly to each other. I am a VIP guest, a personality from the community. Other than a brief intro, I play the game just as the residents do. The host calls someone to the microphone, and the contestant picks a card from the deck. Each card has a question, something to start a story. Who was a teacher that influenced you? Tell us about a time that you watched a sunset with another person. The contestants make their way to the front of the room, some on their own steam, some with walkers, others helped by an aide or a relative. The stories they tell are ordinary ones of life. The time the electricity went out, a typical dinner with family. As each speaks, I find myself simultaneously present in the moment and magically transported as I hear in my head my own parents answering the questions, telling the stories that they would tell. My mother's favorite pet, Amber, a golden retriever so sweet and docile that my cousins named her the breathing carpet. Where did you grow up? My father's Bronx tale, where kids of all ages played in the street together, no arranged playdates until their mothers called them in for dinner. A favorite vacation. They both tell of our family's 6-week journey across the country in our 1972 Chrysler station wagon, complete with a blow-up raft in the back where I, at age 6, slept, well before the days of car seats. The power of life-affirming stories. As I await my turn, I am afraid that whatever question is on the card will call to mind only a story that will be too filled with loss and too personal for this room of my parents' peers. When I hear my name, I go to the front and voluntarily make some face that shows my uncertainty. I get a laugh, and I feel a little more relaxed. When the host asks me to speak about a favorite photograph, I take a deep breath. And when I do talk about my parents, about how the photographs of them are the ones I most enjoy now that they are gone, I tell of a picture of myself and my mother that sits on my mantelpiece. I'm a little girl with a mop of blonde curls, and my mother is holding me. And I tell them that my daughter has the same mop of blonde curls. The stories of the residents, though brief, are filled with gratitude and pathos. One woman says that she is heartbroken to have been forced to leave her home, but others are clearly thriving, and there is much humor. One woman is asked to describe something she wishes she were good at but isn't. Well, she admits that she can't come up with anything and asks if she can list the things that she does well. Another agrees to play the game, but when she gets to the microphone, refuses to answer the question on the card. She has another story to tell. Back in my seat, I feel that rush that comes with being vulnerable and then finding acceptance. We're a family now. Telling our stories is life-affirming. Telling our stories is critical. Our stories are what we will always have left. Author Raina Mardner Genton. Her short fiction has appeared in the Westchester Review and The Right Launch, and her personal essays have been published in many websites. Well, the story of Sam Devine's wooden toy truck sparked a grandparent memory of my own. It must have been in the very early 50s when olives came in a short, slim glass bottle. One olive on every level. My grandfather helped me to cut out some random snippets of magazine pictures to paste on one of those olive jars. When the jar was all covered up with little paint snippets, we painted it, the rim, and then sealed it with shellac to create something like a bud vase. It was well preserved because I was just able to find it about 68 years later in a cupboard where I keep small vases. I'm so very grateful to have that memory revived. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik.